You know, here on No Nonsense Nutrition, I'm always trying to expand the platform. And by that, I mean not just talking about what you should eat. I mean, pretty much we know it by now, don't we? You know, what's amazing is today when I talk about your cardiovascular health, I'm going to be given some of the same clues that I give when we talk about all sorts of other conditions of the body. But we want to understand that there is so much in medicine and science that we can't perceive with our current way of seeing. There's a new framework and a new organizational concept that's needed. You know, when Linus Pauling said, and this time I'll quote, "Although medicine is largely based on sciences, it has not yet become a science." Yeah, we owe Linus Pauling for that quote. We don't have a unifying theory of health and disease. We're just starting to get a picture of what it should look like. So, you know, if we talk about a theory as opposed to a hypothesis, it's a set of facts, it's propositions, it's principles that are analyzed in relation to one another and are used to explain all kinds of phenomenon. You know, theory, unlike hypothesis, is almost always the result of years of investigation. So we're at the edge of finding this new pattern, this new theory of health and disease. The science of medicine today is maturing. And so yesterday's way of thinking that there was a single agent, like a bacteria, that caused a single disease, like an infection, and you treated it with a single molecule like an antibiotic. That's gone the way of the wind. It's being replaced by an understanding of complex functions. We're looking underneath. We're looking at the underlying mechanisms of a disease and aging. You know, genomics has brought us some information. Understanding nutrition, understanding proteins, there's a huge, big shift that takes place virtually on an annual basis. I mean, one of the things that is required of those of us that are in the field of health, if we're going to be any good at it at all, is you got to read constantly. Because as my father said, every night when I go to bed, I wake up the next day dumber because they've discovered something yesterday that I don't know anything about. So medicine is close to discarding this old descriptive way of talking about disease. You know, when we name it, blame it, and tame it, if we're having a 4 to 7 minute appointment, then the most important thing for the clinician to do is to quickly come to a diagnosis. Because as soon as you come to diagnosis, you have a code. And that code is the ICD-9 or the ICD-10 classification of diseases is the way that you can then bill for that appointment. So these subspecialties of medicine, you know, every body part has its own kind of doctor. Well, there's some advantage to specialization, but what we're learning is we got too specialized. You know, the story of the role of nutrients in health and disease is really a useful model to help us shift out of this pathology-based mentality. And so there's been a fundamental change in that perspective. We're not simply treating a disease, we're optimizing function. That's why we call it functional medicine. You know, I've always resisted anybody referring to me as an alternative practitioner. What's the alternative to health? I mean, what's the alternative to food? This is functional medicine. So this old way of diagnosis and classifying diseases according to organ systems, we call it cardiovascular disease. We're talking about the heart. It's really less meaningful today because diseases may have multiple causes. And one initiating factor may create multiple diseases. Cardiovascular disease is certainly an example of that. So we may recognize cardiovascular disease by its particular pathology, that we have atherosclerotic plaques, these plaques or these hardening places that are inside the arterial wall. But they can be triggered by all kinds of things. They can be triggered by insulin resistance or folate deficiency, which certainly happens to 40 to 50% of Americans. 40 to 50% of Americans can't turn folic acid into folate, can't turn folate into its active form. And so they end up with hyperhomocysteinemia. Yeah, you know about homocysteine. Homocysteine is a protein that we don't want to get very high. Even though the blood levels say it's okay to have it 10.7 or lower, I want that number under 8. We could have infections that could trigger atherosclerotic plaques. We could have heavy metal toxicity. We could have stress. All sorts of factors that increase inflammation could cause plaques. So to treat each of these precursors, to treat each of these various conditions, you've got to make an assessment of that. So prescribing that classic low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet, throw in a beta blocker and a statin, actually could make it worse, especially in the person who has insulin resistance or has an occult infection that you haven't found. We're changing the way that we look at these conditions. It's no longer one agent causing one disease that's treated by one molecule. And so it requires that we rethink this. And why is it important to do that with cardiovascular disease? Because 1 out of 3 deaths are from cardiovascular disease in the United States. Now, if that was the human condition, that would be the case all around the world. But it's not the case all around the world. When over 600,000 people die in America every year, 50,000 people every month. 50,000. That's astounding. We're afraid of terrorists, and we're afraid of sharks, and we're afraid of getting hit by lightning. But what's true is heart disease is what kills us. 84 million people in this country suffer from some form of cardiovascular disease. Every 40 seconds, somebody dies from cardiovascular disease. Over 2,000 a day. This is hundreds of billions of dollars, over $300 billion, and the figure is increasing every year. And when I say some form of cardiovascular disease, I have to include coronary heart disease and high blood pressure and undiagnosed diabetes and heart failure and a whole big list. But if you add up cancer and respiratory disease and accidents and you add them all up together, cardiovascular disease still kills more people. And it's not just a man's disease. It's a number one killer of women as well. And a third of those people die before they're 75 years old. You know, when I think about stroke, it's the leading cause of serious long-term disability. It accounts for more than half of all patients that are hospitalized for something neurological going on. And just like somebody dies heart disease every 40 seconds, somebody has a stroke every 40 seconds. Long-term disability. Yikes. And women have a higher lifetime risk of stroke than men do. And since 20% of U.S. adults still smoke cigarettes, that's about $200 billion a year it costs just to treat that. Did you read about the lady, I think it was in South Florida somewhere, I don't remember whether it was Miami or Fort Myers or whatever, who was smoking one of those vapor cigarettes and it blew up, knocked her tooth out, and set her car on fire? How's that for a good reason to quit smoking? I would love to follow through on that story and find out if that woman quit smoking. And you say, well, Eve, that was one of those vape things. It wasn't a real cigarette. Excuse me, you're still doing lung damage. And when you're doing lung damage, you're doing cardiovascular damage. So let's see if we can't understand it a little bit better. And what the National Institutes of Health have done is they've tried to help you understand it better, because you can go up on the National Institute of Health site and now measure your risk over the next 10 years, your risk of having a coronary incident. And you put in your age and your weight and your blood pressure and your cholesterol and whether you smoke or not. And, you know, you put in that information and it computes for you. You can find it at a number of different sites. The American Heart Association, the National Institute of Health. Just type in cardiac risk, and that little test will come up, and you can do it for yourself. And not only are we finding out about that risk, but we're finding out about the relationship to things even like Alzheimer's disease. So if you care about your heart, you can care about your brain. And a lot more people care about their brain than they do about caring about their heart. You know, that's the message of new research that links the deficits in the amount of blood that the heart pumps with each beat to an increased risk of memory loss and dementia. Who knew? There were over 1,000 adults who were participating in this long-term study about cardiac index. That's a measurement of the output of the heart. Individuals who pumped a lower amount of blood through the body for their size had a 2 to 3 times greater risk of developing significant memory loss over an 11-year period as compared with those with normal, vigorous cardiac output. When these things were published in Circulation last year, I thought it was really profound. Because even when participants with heart disease and other heart conditions were excluded from the analysis, a stunning 1 out of 3 people that were in the study met the medical definition of a low cardiac index. In other words, the muscle itself gets sloppy. I compare it to the elastic in old underwear. That elastic in old underwear just doesn't have the snap it did before. So we're learning that a brain-healthy lifestyle is really an extension of a heart-healthy lifestyle. Save the heart, you save the brain. Now, we've known for some time that a lower cardiac index can be associated with abnormal brain aging, negative changes in the brain's white matter, smaller brain volume, and worse cognitive performance. You know, the words brain and atrophy are not something you want to have in the same sentence, because we have a greater risk for dementia. And what I see in my practice, especially over the last 5 years, has been individuals who very, very clearly are more concerned about their brain than they are their body. So if you get an echocardiogram, and the echocardiogram or an ultrasound of the heart, that's one of the ways that you can measure cardiac output. But you know when you go in to the physician and they stick this little gizmo on your finger that's called a pulse oximeter? It gets clamped onto your finger. Sometimes it gets clamped onto your earlobe. But someplace where the blood flow runs close to the skin, and they actually measure the saturation of blood oxygen. And so you want a 99. You want a 98. We know that there's lots of oxygen in your blood. The heart is pumping well. So we want to maximize our heart health. And the first place we do that is by exercising regularly. You know, there is no single fountain of youth like exercise. It reduces our risk of dementia. It reduces our risk of cardiovascular disease. It reduces our risk of cancer. Reduces our risk of depression. So you can hear that it's 30 minutes a day. Or an hour 3 times a week. But any is better than none, and more is better than any. So start right there. Start right there by looking at what do you do to be active. Yesterday I was in the yard, and I had an empty garbage can, And an hour later, I had a full garbage can because of all the trimmings and the bending and the pulling and the cutting. And that's exercise. No, I don't go to a gym or wear funny spandex clothes. But exercise is movement. We're designed to move. Because it's one of the things that can keep our blood pressure normal. And control of high blood pressure, well, it continues to improve in this country. We've gotten really good at medicating blood pressure down. But I still see people in my clinic that are even on blood pressure medications that their blood pressure is not in the target zone. You know, when we're looking for that optimal blood pressure, less than 120 over 80, I have people that come into my clinic and they're on blood pressure medication and their blood pressure is still 140 plus over 90 plus. Blood pressure is related to two things. The heart pumping through the arteries and the force of the arteries resisting the blood flow. With every heartbeat, with every downstroke, the blood pressure rises. And between beats, it falls. And that's why the top figure, the systolic number, is when the heart is squeezing or pumping, and the lower number is the pressure when your heart is at rest between beats. And so you've got a little bit of a muscle inside that artery that causes the artery to just sort of clamp down just a little bit. Otherwise, your blood pressure would be 120-0. You wouldn't be able to maintain consciousness. But uncontrolled high blood pressure both causes and accelerates atherosclerosis. Remember, sclerosis means hardening. The arteries get stiff and they get narrow, and that forces the heart to work harder in an attempt to pump sufficient blood out into the body. Atherosclerosis is the most common underlying factor in heart disease. And even though the overall mortality for heart disease has declined over the last decade, well, this century, this millennium, the mortality rate for high blood pressure has actually increased. It's a major contributing factor for heart attack, for stroke, and for chronic kidney disease. Plus, it damages vision by damaging the little teeny tiny blood vessels in the eyes. You know, at one time, unless your systolic pressure was higher than 140, nobody suggested doing any treatment. But in the guidelines that were published just about 2 years ago, they propose less restrictive blood pressure targets for adults that are 60 and over, and for those with diabetes and chronic kidney disease. The guidelines are based on a review that found really no difference in the outcomes between systolic treatment targets of 140 and 150 in people over 60 years old. And so some people, I can remember when I lived in Colorado and I had a client, and he said that he'd just been to his cardiologist the prior week, and the cardiologist told him if he'd come on Thursday, he would have told him his cholesterol was fine, but he came on Friday and they'd changed the guidelines. Well, the same story with blood pressure. The Joint National Committee that published these guidelines increased the systolic blood pressure treatment goal from less than 140 over 90 to less than 150 over 90. But the point is moot. Both of those things are too high. You're creating damage. Think about pressure. Think about that brass nozzle on your garden hose. When you twist it down and the pressure increases, you can literally erode the dirt under your feet. But if you open that valve completely up, the water just falls out of the end of the hose. The same thing is true as far as your arteries are concerned. You don't have a piece of artery, you don't have a piece of vein in your body that's practically an inch long straight. It's all wiggly squiggly, just like the delta of a river. And what's true is because that blood is going there under this high pressure, it's slamming into the walls of your arteries. And that's how it's beginning to create damage. Actually, even things like yoga can be as effective as traditional exercises in reducing cardiovascular disease risk factors. There was a great review that was done in the Journal of Preventive Cardiology in Europe. and it reviewed 37 studies, almost 3,000 people. And when compared with no exercise, yoga was associated with a significant improvement in every risk factor that was measured, from body mass index to blood pressure to, you know, the reduction of poor cholesterol, the increase of good cholesterol, the improvement in heart rate. And this was true whether people were taking medication or not. Yoga lowered LDL cholesterol in patients with existing coronary heart disease, those who were taking statins and lipid-lowering drugs. It's a pretty cost-effective treatment. It's a pretty good preventive strategy, especially for people who are unable to engage in aerobic fitness exercises. So what are we talking about so far? We're saying we got to improve the oxygenation to the brain. That's improving the cardiac index. We've got to improve the blood pressure numbers. You need to know where what they are. You know, if you're going to the grocery store, you're going to the drugstore, don't race in from the parking lot and sit down and take your blood pressure right away. Wait a few minutes. Sit in the chair. 3 minutes. Turn over an egg timer. I know all of you carry one in your pocket. Just sit for a minute. And take your blood pressure on the same machine all the time. If you go to the grocery store every Saturday, then take it on that machine every Saturday. Better yet, buy yourself a blood pressure meter at home. That's a smart thing to do. Well, cholesterol is the other story. You know, everybody talks about how your cholesterol needs to be bottomed out. Well, there's new guidelines. Why do we keep having new guidelines? Because we keep learning new things. That's why. The Million Hearts Initiative was a program that was launched by the United States Department of Health and Human Services back 5 years ago. It was aimed at preventing 1 million heart attacks and strokes by this year. Well, the goal hasn't been met. There are still a lot of people with pretty unhealthy behaviors. Some people, they grow up eating that food, and that's the food they're going to eat. So when we look at the weekly reports, Center for Disease Control puts out a morbidity and mortality weekly report, and that's where I get some of this data. So in this Million Hearts study, one of the things they were looking at are statin drugs. And there's the good, the bad, and the ugly to say about statin drugs. A lot of people are prescribed statin drugs. People that are at risk for cardiovascular events, over 43% of them are prescribed statin drugs. 5 years ago, it was only 33%. And now that number is likely to increase. The guidelines have shifted the focus from treating specific cholesterol numbers to looking at an individual's risk of having a heart attack or stroke. But it could cause a huge big increase in the number of people that are recommended statins, from over 40 million to over 50 million. Gee, I wonder if Big Pharma had any influence on that. Well, the issues still remain that statins shouldn't be seen as a magic bullet. Statins have never been studied in older women. In women over 60 years old, who's on more statins than anybody else? Men 40 and up and women 60 and up. And yet, they've never been studied. And what we see is an increased risk of developing diabetes with statin drugs. I've told the story many times on the air of Dr. Duane Graveline. Dr. Graveline was a Navy physician, and he became an astronaut. He was one of the astronauts in the early astronaut programs. And because of that, they go to Houston, every one of them, every year, and get a physical because they're keeping huge amounts of data on these men and women. And Dr. Graveline's cholesterol was a little bit elevated, a little over 200, and his doctor put him on 10 milligrams of Lipitor, one of the statins that actually shows real effect. And Dr. Graveline took the Lipitor, and 6 weeks later, his wife found him wandering around in the driveway, and he didn't recognize her. He had temporary global amnesia. He didn't remember that he was a doctor. He didn't remember that he was an astronaut. He didn't remember his wife. His memory returned after 17 hours, and Dr. Graveline knew that the only thing that was different that is he was taking 10 milligrams of statins. And even though everybody said statins don't do that, he discontinued the use of the statin drug, never had another memory issue all year. A year later, went back to Houston, was chastised by his physician for not staying on the drug. Dr. Graveline agreed to go back on the drug at half dose at 5 milligrams. 6 weeks later, his wife found him wandering, didn't recognize him, didn't remember being an astronaut or a doctor, and didn't remember anything after the high school prom. He retrograded back to age 17. This episode of TGA, or transient global amnesia, lasted longer than the first one, and then Dr. Graveline was absolutely convinced that the statin drug had caused the memory loss, but he couldn't find anybody to agree with him. There was no physician at the hospital, the NASA people, all of his, you know, colleagues. Everybody said, statins don't do that. And then he wrote a letter to the doctor who used to have the column in the paper every day and told his story and asked for correspondence from anybody who had had a similar thing happen. And 4,000 people wrote back to him. You can find his information on spacedoc.com, the story of Dr. Graveline's work to demonstrate that statins are not quite as safe as we think. And yet, 43 million people take them. A lot of them take them with the belief that statins can make up for a sedentary lifestyle and poor dietary choices. You can't do it. You can't do it and expect that you can have all of these lousy habits and the statin user is going to, you know, change their risk factors. Not going to happen. You know, there used to be a time when I thought Crestor was the safest of the statin drugs because it doesn't cross the brain barrier. But after looking at the new data and seeing that Crestor causes more rhabdomyolysis, more breakdown of muscle tissue, you've heard of people that when they start taking a statin, they just ache. They ache like they just laid a brick patio. Their muscles just ache. They can actually end up with kidney failure as a result. Crestor causes that more than any other single drug. Yes, there are places where the use of statin drugs is a smart thing, especially in the year after you've had a heart attack, especially after you've had coronary surgery. But reducing cholesterol alone doesn't always reduce inflammation, and it's inflammation that causes the body to lay down what becomes the plaque. And it doesn't matter where the inflammation is. It doesn't matter whether you get a splinter in your finger or you break your foot. It doesn't matter whether you have chronic headaches or chronic indigestion. Inflammation anywhere in the body speeds the process of disease. It's the foundation of diabetes. It's the foundation of coronary disease. It's the foundation of dementias. So we want to keep inflammation quieted. And it can happen from foods. I just spent a week in North Carolina, you know, part of the stroke belt. Yeah, we have a stroke belt in this country. And when I look at the way that North Carolinians eat, for the most part, I see fried, 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 and fried. Did I mention fried? If you can cook it, they can fry it. So whether it's fried fish or French fries or fried, 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 it's those nasty trans fats. It's those nasty hydrogenated oils that are the culprit. You know, the body doesn't know what to do with those things. I've talked about them so many times on the air because I want you to be afraid. Be very afraid. Those oils are nasty. We change the shape of the molecule, you change the function of the molecule. When you change the shape of the molecule, you alter the way that the cell wall works. And so when we're eating fatty and marbled meat, when we're eating full fat dairy products, when we're eating organ meat and hot dogs and sausages and bacon and fried, you know, somebody's sitting at the next table and they're eating a piece of fried fish and they're going, you know, fish is good for you. Well, yeah, it is. No question about the fact that fish is good for you. But by the time you bread it and deep fat fry it, it don't be so good for you. So let's understand that hydrogenated, partially hydrogenated, they're going to be banned. You know, the jury's not out anymore. Those are things that are really nasty for your heart. So, yes, there are things you can do. The first thing you can do is control your portion size. Avoid overloading your plate and taking seconds and eating until you feel stuffed. You know, most portions served in restaurants are more than anyone really needs. You know, lots of studies have shown that using a small plate, a small bowl, a small spoon changes how you eat. And you go, oh, Eve, that's so silly. Anybody would figure that out. Well, even professionals didn't figure it out. You know, when they went to the dietetic concert and they put ice cream on both ends of the ballroom and small spoons and small bowls at one table and large spoons and large bowls at the other table, even professional dietitians ate 40% more ice cream when they had a large bowl and a large spoon. So even nutrition professionals could not resist the temptation to change their portion size simply because of the size of their implements. We should be one plate people. One plate. You know, a half a cup of pasta is all you need. I went to a Thai restaurant while I was up in Waynesville, and about 45 minutes from Asheville. And I told my husband, let's split this order. And he said, well, we'll have to get something else. I said, no, I've eaten in this restaurant before. Trust me. We're going to split this order of pad thai with vegetables and tofu. And when they brought it to the table, they had separated it. And what they gave us was still twice as much food as anybody needed. A serving of pasta should be a half a cup. I mean, it's the size of a hockey puck. And if you don't know what that means, then I'm going to have you join the world. You know, judging a serving size is a learned skill. You know, you may need to use measuring cups and spoons or a scale until you're comfortable with your own judgment. But, you know, I talk to people about deck of card size and tennis ball size and, you know, the size of your fist and using measurements like that. But what's really true is we just need to eat a little bit less. You know, I had a client that came to me years ago, and she wanted to lose 15 pounds, and she had a reunion to go to. And so we put her on a program to get some weight off of her, and the next time she came into the clinic, she'd lost a dress size. She was totally thrilled, but she hadn't lost an ounce. She'd begun to change her body shape. She was losing fat and gaining muscle and, you know, was really pleased with that. So we did a more refined program, you know, counting carbs, counting grams, doing stuff like that. And months later, she came back in. She'd lost a second dress size. And she was thrilled, but she hadn't lost an ounce. And so at that point, we had done a bioelectric impedance analysis on her, which is a measurement of how much of her body is muscle and how much of her body is fat. And she definitely changed her ratios. I mean, she was doing a good job, but she hadn't lost an ounce. And so I said, why don't you just take a tablespoon? And when you fill your plate up, just take a tablespoon off of each serving. 1 tablespoon less of chicken and 1 tablespoon less of green beans and 1 tablespoon, no, even if it's a low-calorie thing like green beans, as long as they're not soaked in butter. Doesn't matter whether it's pasta or the creamed corn. It doesn't matter what it is. Just take a little bit off of it. Don't eat half. Don't take off a third. Just a little bit. And get a great big Tupperware and throw that into the Tupperware and keep it in the refrigerator and do that all week long. And at the end of the week, she called me up and she said, I get it. That's a lot of food. So controlling your portion size, how much you eat, is just as important as what you eat. So start there. You know darn good and well, I'm always going to tell you to eat more fruits and vegetables. Do you know that for every 7 ounces of fruit that you eat, your risk of coronary disease goes down, get ready for this, wait for it, 32%. 32% with 7 ounces of fruit. That's astounding. So I had my fruit today, just like I do Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. I start my day with the fruit and the Greek yogurt. The Greek yogurt gives me my 17 to 20 grams of protein. And the fruit, I get a lot of variety. I had blueberries and raspberries and strawberries and papaya and pineapple this morning. 7 ounces of fruit, 32% reduction in heart disease. 7 ounces of vegetables, easy to do. Having a salad at lunch, having a couple of vegetables at dinner, reduces your heart disease another 11%. That's astounding. Fruits and vegetables are good sources of vitamins and minerals. They're low in calories. They're rich in fiber. They contain substances that are found in plants that help prevent cardiovascular disease, that help prevent cancers. We want to feature them in our diet. You know, I grew up with the Eisenhower diet. Ma, what's for dinner? Pork chop. Ma, what's for dinner? Meatloaf. Ma, what's for dinner? The answer was always the meat. There was always vegetables on the plate. Usually boiled potatoes and something green out of a can. But what was really true is the answer was the meat. We want to limit the creamy sauces. We want to limit the fried and breaded vegetables. We want to limit the canned fruit that's packed in syrup. But getting those fruits and vegetables. When people say, oh, I don't know how to read these labels, stop buying stuff with labels. Broccoli is broccoli. That's it. Whole grains are good sources of fiber. They're good sources of other nutrients. They play a role in regulating blood pressure and heart health. My mom said an only good loaf of bread is a bread that'll hold a door open in a storm, meaning it's got to be heavy. So avoiding that refined flour, and we're not just talking about gluten-containing grains. You know, if you're eating gluten-free stuff, you may be eating too much rice flour and too much tapioca flour and too much potato flour. White refined flour is white refined flour, no matter what grain it's made from. I just looked the other day at a calorie counter and found out that the pumpkin muffin at Panera's has 600 calories in it. People get the pumpkin muffin. Oh, that looks healthy. Let's have a pumpkin muffin. And then they go to Jamba Juice and they get a green smoothie that's got 600 calories in it. So now they have a green smoothie and a pumpkin muffin, and they have over 1,200 calories, probably as many calories as they needed in virtually the whole day, and they had it in what they thought was a healthy snack. So you're going to eat cereal. If you're a cereal eater, make sure there's 5 grams or more of fiber in a serving. Look on the pack and look at see what a serving size is. Is it a half a cup? Is it 1 cup? You know, use whole grains like brown rice and buckwheat. Oatmeal, steel cut, or regular, not that cream of paste nonsense that comes in the packet that you tear open and throw in the microwave. Now, personally, I don't like whole grain pasta. Even when I ate gluten-containing grains, which I do not do any longer, I never liked whole grain pasta. Tip of the hat to you if you do. But I would rather take regular pasta, grate up some yellow squash or zucchini or other vegetables, saute some onions and mushrooms, and put that in with the tomato sauce and just have less overall. But if you look on your bread and the first ingredient says refined wheat flour, no. You want 100% whole wheat or 100% whole grain. So, yeah, we're still going to have a piece of cornbread or a pie or an egg noodle or a snack cracker, but really try to get as much whole grain into you as you can. It lowers your risk of diabetes very significantly. In addition to talking about limiting unhealthy fats, we want to remember to limit those unhealthy fats from protein sources. And that's fundamentally the lunch meats. I was reading stats last night on individuals that have heart failure and the nature of heart failure, how much it increased when people were eating 2.5 ounces of lunch meat a day. Well, I had a client that came in, and he's a landscape worker, and he stops at one of the local sub shops every single day, 5 days a week, 21 meals a month. He eats one of those mixed meat subs. So, yeah, he puts lettuce and tomato on it, iceberg lettuce and pesticide-laden tomato. But he eats that 3 ounces of lunch meat day after day after day after day. Well, last night was the first time I found out that that related to heart failure. Cardiac arrest. An inability of the heart to pump. All of those things increased with just 2.5 ounces of lunch meat on a regular basis. And it didn't happen when people were eating a roast beef sandwich, when it wasn't lunch meat. So yes, we want low-fat dairy products, and yes, we want eggs. We always want eggs. We always want that good choline that's in the egg yolk. You know, we want the fishes. Remember, it's Alaskan and Pacific salmon as often as possible. But the other fatty cold-water fishes. You know, fish oil is antifreeze for fishes. That's how they can swim in water that is below 32 degrees and not freeze. And so that lubrication does a lot for you. So when we look at haddock and cod and Arctic char, all of these things are beneficial as protein sources. All the birds, any of the birds, just don't eat the skin. Every time I talk about duck, you know, I get clients that come in and they're eating chicken. And I say, why don't you eat duck? Ooh, that's really fatty. That's the first response that I get most often. No, it's not. I buy those 2 duck breasts at the local store here, and they've got a piece of skin on them, and you lay them skin side down and cook them for 10 minutes and then turn them over for 3 minutes and just peel that skin off, and they're lean. So it's always skinless poultry. Beans, I had white bean soup yesterday. White beans, fabulous for your heart. Soybeans, soy products. You know, when people say, oh, soy is dangerous, you're reading yesterday's news. Soy is a bean, period. You just want to make sure it's organic. You know, 50% of all the genetically modified foods that are grown in the United States in 2015 were soy, the majority of which is fed to livestock. But if you're going to eat soy, it doesn't matter whether it's edamame or tofu or tempeh or soy milk or any of them. Just make sure it's organic, please. Lean ground meats, fine. Remember, if you're going to eat animals that have 4 legs, you want to eat things that have the word loin and round in the name. Eye round, top round, sirloin, tenderloin. And don't forget that there's the omega-3 fatty acids that are in cold water fish also show up in flaxseed and walnuts and soybeans. So you can be a vegetarian and still get those omega-3s. You can also get them from algae supplements, the same place that the fish get them. Reduce the sodium in your food. Where do you get the sodium? You get the sodium from prepared foods. I picked up a can of tomato soup at my friend's house to fix with our lunch one day. And I looked at that can of tomato soup, and it was concentrated, or what they call condensed tomato soup. So you're supposed to use a can of soup and a can of water, or a can of soup and a can of milk, or whatever. And I looked at that can, and it had 900 milligrams of sodium per serving. And there were 2.5 servings. Now, you know the size of a can of soup. 2.5 servings. Who would look at that can and think that, even when it was mixed with the water, it was going to be 2.5 servings. 900 milligrams of sodium. 2 times that, 1,800. And another 450 on top, 2,250 milligrams of sodium. That's as much or more that you should get in a day. Healthy adults should never have more than 2,300 milligrams. That's about a teaspoon of salt. By the time you're over 50 years old, and especially if you're African American, or if you already have high blood pressure, or you already have diabetes, or you already have kidney disease, you shouldn't have more than 1,500 milligrams of sodium. All you would have had to do is have a generous bowl of this condensed tomato soup, and you would have gotten to the 1,500. So reducing the amount of salt you add to food at the table or cooking is a good first step, but most of the salt comes from canned and processed foods like soups and frozen dinners and barbecue sauce and salad dressings. And if you like the convenience of canned soup, and I keep a couple of cans of tomato bisque usually in the pantry, you know, we do that hurricane preparation. Look for the ones with reduced sodium. And remember, sea salt doesn't make it better. Using sea salt instead of regular table salt is not an advantage. It's not an advantage, first off, because you need the iodine. If you're going to buy sea salt, buy iodized sea salt, but it doesn't have less sodium. Now, we know that not everybody in America is sensitive to sodium, that it doesn't affect high blood pressure, but it does affect the wall of the artery. People that are high salt eaters, even if it doesn't change your blood pressure, it thickens or hardens the wall of the artery. So it's not atherosclerotic plaque, it's sclerosis of the artery, arteriosclerosis, when we have too much sodium in the diet. Using herbs and spices, using salt substitutes, using reduced salt versions of any kind of condiments, from soy sauce to ketchup, from canned soup to prepared meals. All of those things can make a difference. And begin to look at the day. Instead of just looking at the meal, you want to bring these strategies together within the day. Know what your next meal is going to be. Know what you're going to eat tonight for dinner. Plan ahead. Look at that plate like a childhood cafeteria plate with divisions in it, and half of that plate should be vegetables. A fourth of that plate should be protein, and a fourth of that plate should be starch. And sometimes that starch is going to be grain starch, like a piece of bread or a serving of rice. And sometimes that starch is going to be a vegetable starch. It's going to be a butternut squash. It's going to be an ear of corn. It's going to be potatoes. But you can't eat too many vegetables. And so when we look at the food over the day, maybe your veggies are all going to come to you at lunchtime as salad and at dinner as cooked vegetables. Maybe you're not a salad eater. Maybe it's a bowl of soup together with that skinless poultry sandwich on whole grain bread. But start to look at daily menus. Emphasize vegetables, fruit, and whole grain. Lean protein sources, healthy fats, limiting salty foods. it's the lifestyle changes that we're really looking for. The lifestyle changes are what give us the opportunity to end up having a healthy heart. So you've got an opportunity to change your future. And you change your future by maximizing your heart health. We don't know everything there is to know about heart disease. But we do know that stress contributes. All of us have stress. You know what the single biggest stress is? I've never been able to find anybody who's been able to guess this right. The single biggest stress is temperature stress. If you're too hot, you can't think about anything except cooling off. And if you're too cold, you can't think about anything except getting warm. We think stress is our mother-in-law or the traffic or our bills. But stress can be all sorts of things. That's one of the reasons that we say that yoga created benefits in all the way across the board. But when we look at the opportunity that we have to reduce our stress, we want to find a way to reduce our stress other than just having a cocktail. We want to find things to do that are really pleasant, things to do that bring us a smile. I've said repeatedly on the air, I love working in the yard, but I love having a hose in my hand. I love to water things. I don't know why that is so stress reductive, but it is. So don't forget the emotional and psychological part of heart disease. Don't forget that doing things that make you laugh and give you joy and make you forget the time, you know, the hours that sped away when you were a kid because you were playing, you need to find something that does that same sort of thing for you as an adult. Because even if you eat perfect, if you got yourself worked up all the time, it's not going to help your heart. It's going to raise your cortisol. It's going to raise your stress hormones, and that's going to affect your heart. Let's change these statistics. You know, in Japan, only 7% of deaths are from heart disease. In Italy, it's about 15. Some parts of South America, it's about 25. So heart disease is not the human condition. But it's certainly the condition here in America, and we can change that future by changing our choices. And I double dog dare you to start doing it today. I'm Eve Prang-Plues. I'm a licensed nutrition counselor. I've been in practice here in Sarasota for 28 years. I'm a certified practitioner from the Institute for Functional Medicine, and happy to say that I am.